Street Voices, Broadsides, and the Working Class Press. Read all about it. The world's turned upside down, or a brief description of the ridiculous fashions of these distracted times. By TJ, a well-willer to King, Parliament, and Kingdom. Printed, actually, in the 17th century, 200 years or so after Johannes Gutenberg had effectively put the printing press to first use. So in previous weeks, we've looked at the growing importance of the press in terms of how it transmitted political ideas, how it transmitted news to the increasing readership that was growing in Britain. We've seen that literacy rates, although difficult to measure, as we said, sometimes people were embarrassed to say that they could read if they were wives of husbands and they knew more than their husbands actually did. Sometimes people only marked things with an X when they were signing for things. So difficult to actually measure, but they were increasing. And as I mentioned last time, it's been estimated that in between 1780 and 1830, the whole of the population of England doubled from about 7 million to 14 million. That also meant that the number of readers quadrupled from 1.5 million to between 7 and 8 million. And in today's lecture, I want to actually turn away from an explicit consideration of the impact of print and journalism upon the political world of the early 19th century, things like the Peterloo Massacre, things like use of satire and so on, to really consider consider the popular press. Consider what people were actually reading at the time and what it also revealed about Britain's new readership. Because the audience is fundamental when you're writing. If you're not sure who you're writing for, clearly it's no point putting together a very sophisticated argument if you're dealing with an unsophisticated audience. We're also going to be looking at some of the key influential writers from the broadsides who really actually started catering for this popular mass market. So let's begin by explaining some of the history behind broadsides in general, and also how this literature fad was really developing and growing. It's been argued that the development of a print culture encouraged the growth of a readership. Again, makes sense. If you've got one, you might well have the other. So as you develop that work of print, more and more people, if they're going to purchase the print copies, will need to read it. And the development of a culture which was dominated by print also brought about the weakening of what was known as oral culture. Walter Ong, ONG, is an academic who's worked quite closely with this and really looked at the whole notion of how oral cultures actually work and develop. And what you see as characteristics of oral cultures are things like superstitions, beliefs in old wives' sayings, folk tales. Many of those areas were very much part of distinctive parts of Britain, whether it was Yorkshire, whether it was Lincolnshire. There was very rarely a village you could go to that didn't actually have some kind of folk tale associated with it, many of which do still survive in the 21st century. But this transition from an oral culture to a print culture also came about and facilitated by industrialisation. Okay. It helped produce in the audience exactly the type of rational, disciplined workforce that was actually needed by an increasingly capitalised place of employment. Into the 19th century and beyond, it's also been assumed by many that literacy had a profound impact on a person's moral and overall character. So how they actually behaved, how they effectively sort of were as worthwhile, productive members of society, was often marked by how educated they actually were. Sir James K. Shuttleworth was a gentleman who hoped to provide an education calculated to develop the entire moral and intellectual capacity of the whole nation. So some very lofty ideals being used to justify why education was being used. And folk who actually wrote about literacy studies and gaining literacy skills often had something about them which was almost like being converted to a new religion. It was the zeal of the converts. Ben Brearley actually said that it was in every sense a new light shone on me. Robert Story, who was a shepherd, noted that the effect on my mind was magical. Henry Price, who was a cabinet maker, when he first discovered the world of print, he actually wrote that my eyes were opened, it seemed for the first time in my life. Suddenly you're seeing the world in a new way. You're having a paradigm shift to being able to see something more than just squiggles on a page, more than just a drawing, actually what was being printed was there. And working class workers who clearly had gained the skills of literacy often wrote disparagingly about the world of oral culture from which they'd emerged. A world which was invariably populated by spirits and demons and charms and magic and superstition and such like. But a few of the lonely out-of-the-way places, according to Samuel Bamford, actually were populated by the dark of lanes, the solitary houses. They were haunted by fairies, by boggarts, by beings of terror, by Satan and such like. Superstition could be rife. Beware the dark places. Thomas Miller once declared that, of course, there were firm believers in ghosts in all villages. In the East Riding, according to John Nicholson, in the early 19th century, every village and town was home to some form of apparition, ghost, demon or other. So part of print culture was getting away from that by actually abandoning an oral tradition, by printing elements that were there. And such 19th century accounts tend to suggest, either directly or indirectly, that an increasingly literate population would also help bring about a replacement of the old and a renewal of rational thinking. And that there was no place for oral superstitions and magic in the new world. As Lovett, who was a London cabinet maker, obviously commented when he wrote in the early 19th century, "My mind seemed awakened to a new mental existence. New feelings, hopes and aspirations sprang up upon me, and every spare moment was devoted to the acquisition of some kind of useful knowledge." So the focus being very much on learning as a viable, useful thing, that it wasn't a case of just populating your mind with trash. But how typical was that as an overview of the typical public taste? We hear a classic line now that you don't make millions through overestimating the public intelligence. And did all such readers at the time thirst for some kind of useful knowledge which could actually help transform society? Certainly over the last couple of lectures, much printed matter, which was coming off the press, targeted readers that were aimed at people like Lovett, people who had a sophistication and an understanding either of the political object of the satire or of the commentary that was being raised or the issues that were at hand and so on. The printing press was being portrayed as some kind of evangelist on the one hand, a way in which people could actually use knowledge as a powerful weapon to develop, and as we saw 2 weeks ago, the pen mightier than the sword, from the sketch last week of Hone and Cruikshank. Nevertheless, I think it's still wrong to actually see print culture as simply overthrowing oral culture in a straightforward manner. Things are often not that easy in terms of historical research, in terms of journalistic research. And many folk who actually made their living writing and publishing in the first half of the 19th century were very much aware of the continued vibrancy of the oral culture, the oral tradition, the tradition that actually not only led to balladeers and singers and minstrels moving from one village to another, but also actually developed work of writers and illustrators that we're going to consider in this particular piece. As the writer Louis James stated in Poet and the People, there was a division within the working class. There were those for whom reading was only for entertainment, and those for whom reading was actually part of a changing pattern of cultural expectation. In other words, not all working class readers were like William Lovett, desperately reading to acquire some brand new kind of knowledge, and useful knowledge as well at the same time. Many did so, at least initially, purely for pleasure. Reading for reading's sake. Reading because it's fun. Because you want to find out about the excesses of society. You want to find out about the disasters, the lines and the problems that work through on that basis. And the vast majority of working class readers who read for entertainment would actually be seeking out street literature. Literature that was cheap or relatively cheap, easily available, picked up on your way to work and read and disseminated on the way home or over lunch or whatever. Sort of similar to the metro readers perhaps of today in many ways. The kind of folk who would be looking for the scandal, the impact, the lines that work through in this particular instance, dreadful accident, loss of life, a full, true and particular account of that dreadful accident which occurred in this city on Saturday afternoon by the falling in of a house in Picardy Place, which crowded with company of the first respectability attending the sale of the late Lord Eldon's pictures, giving the full particulars of that melancholy catastrophe with the names of the unfortunate sufferers. The content of most broadsides and street literature often was written by anonymous writers. It drew heavily upon themes that were popular in oral tradition. Broadsides, which are called broadsides because often they were printed on one side of the paper only, so they could also be posted up, not unlike what I've actually put up from that point of view, and stuck on the actual walls. But they covered a range of subjects. The key ones were religion, crime, and romance. Those were the big sellers. Superstition and tragedy were also fairly close behind. And if you could have a superstitious crime tied in with romance and tragedy, brilliant, it's a winner. You're looking at touching those areas and hitting those particular aspects. Some of the broadsides purported to produce accurate awareness and accurate accounts of issues and news stories to its readership, a true and faithful account. They claimed that they were telling the truth, just the facts. Criminals about to be executed would have their confessions actually ghostwritten and printed. And those confessions of criminals about to be executed would be sold on the streets to great popularity. These were people who were about to be killed, or possibly would be killed by the time the issues had actually gone to press. But it was the last dying will and testament of murderers, the most popular ones that were developed within that whole field, the sort of issues that were coming through there, the trial and execution of Captain Henry Nichols, who suffered this morning, Horsemonger Lane Jail, Southwark, the particulars of the life, trial, character and behaviour of Margaret Dixon, aged 22, who was executed at Edinburgh on Monday, February the 1st, 1813, for the murder of her bastard child. It's really tapping into that almost salacious aspect of human nature, which really likes to find out the scandal, dig the dirt and so on, find these sort of aspects. Henry Mayhew, who you may recall was the founder of Punch, before he actually founded Punch, he actually engaged in a number of interviews that asked the writers of broadsides what they did, why they did and so on. And actually sort of did a study which reveals that in London, there were effectively 2.5 million sheets, broadsides and sheets, which were sold in 18 to 19 over the murderer James Bloomfield Rush. Other broadsheet tales purporting to be news were entirely apocryphal, and they relayed on the page and related to the traditional oral issues, oral tales. You have stories concerning a pig-faced lady who was effectively available and needed a husband. Face like a pig? Needs a husband? All sorts of things. You can find these actually online and simply Google broadsides. You'll find a whole range of examples that were there. In other words, broadsides were also cheap books. They were ways to actually indulge, escape for a wee while. the official life that you were part of. Some of the broadsheets were new sheets that were folded into quarters and then sixteenths, etc., with a sparse coloured cover that was fairly lurid in terms of its output from that point of view. And they were sold extensively both during the 18th century, during the early 19th century, and so on. One of the key predominant publishers of the time was C. Dicey, D-I-C-E-Y. Although, again, many unscrupulous booksellers would actually pirate Dicey stock, so they'd actually take the original things that Dicey had introduced and plagiarise and simply palm them off as their own material as well. During the early part of the 19th century, the most dominant publishers of street literature were the London-based Catnach, C-A-T-N-A-C-H family. James Catnach was actually born in Berwick-on-Tweed, but eventually he went down to London. And Catnach effectively produced a whole range of stories for the broadside market. Why was this so effective? Well, the actual cost of publishing was fairly minimal. Often second-hand type was actually being used, especially from the sale of the sort of issues that were sort of put into place within that. Any stories like murders would guarantee bestsellers, and Catnach is reported to have actually earned £10,000 on the sale of simply penny and halfpenny broadsheets. So it's big business. Although many of the readers of broadsides would rely upon this literature for news, the broadside news content was notoriously variable. Catnach actually brought up whatever false statement or bought up whatever false statement or story he thought would actually sell. It really didn't matter if you let the facts get in the way of the story. As long as it was likely to sell, you'd put it out there. Hence the reason that you get all sorts of other areas. Cited Maria Martin there because Maria cause célèbre, she was at the time the subject of one of the most popular broadsides, and actually the broadside that was responsible or that contained Maria Martin's last confession sold well over 1 million copies. So again, and also illustrated by artists purported to be real, all sorts of aspects relating to that. Inevitably, Catnach's success was guaranteed through the publication of the popular press, as murders and last dying confessions, like the ones we've already looked at, all made a certain infamy very popular. So it was really trading on that notion of infamy and aspects relating to that. In contrast, other cheap broadsides were readily available. Cheap book publishers in the early 19th century could be found across England and Scotland. There were cheap book publications, as they referred to, and chapbooks in Edinburgh, in Glasgow, in Falkirk, Carlisle, Penrith, York, Worcester, Aylesbury, Cirencester, and a whole range of other towns as well. What did these things actually do? Well, they filled an important gap in the supply of reading material, as we said. People learn how to read. They want stuff to read. They don't simply want to repeat the same thing they've been reading time and time again. They want more of that whole thing. You may, in certain instances, actually use popular lines and popular illustrations to address moral issues. This particular piece of The Drunkard's Progress, which starts off with a glass with a friend, moves through to the peak there of a jovial or jolly company, etc., all the way down to death by suicide, and the message that comes across here, the widow and child left grieving, homeless, and so on. So you've got a kind of educational message that comes across there in terms of the advertisements that's used, that's printed out, to again return to the notion of these elements of literature being meant to improve people, to actually get back to a notion of saying, look, we want to improve people's moral character and fibre and so on. There are lots of contemporary equivalents to, you know, alcohol and so on, drink a little less, that we can actually find in our contemporary world. Little's actually known, as I've mentioned, about the writers of the broadsides, particularly during the 18th and 19th century, because much of the writing was anonymised. You know, people would churn it out, print it, sell it, move from that perspective onwards. It was cheap, wasn't necessarily cheerful, but it was actually sort of relatively easy to access. As I mentioned, Henry Mayhew also noted that songs were also associated with broadsides. Those songs actually assisted in selling and buying the paper. You would, in the streets of Lincoln, have singers who would ring, who would sing out a couple of verses of the ballad that was actually there. If you wanted to find out how the story would end, you had to buy the newspaper, buy the newsprint, etc. This broadside seller, or chanteurs, C-H-A-U-N-T-E-R-S, as they're often referred to, actually earned more than the writers, a lot more than the writers. The task of the chanteur was to bring to life the story or song, portraying it dramatically, to various tunes, many of which might be hymns of the day, that they actually used to work through that. And again, the reason for their existence was to catch the eye of potential buyers. So if you heard a familiar tune being sung about, which was relating to a particular story you might have heard, you'd buy a copy and so on. And that presentation or marketing, which effectively it was vitally important. A character would normally sing it in a monotonous, flat twang to conserve his voice and to be heard above other street noises. That sort of initial street, you know, gizette and so on would actually sort of work within the field. And patter would effectively include local gossip in order to attract an audience. So you'd gather people round to actually say, why should you listen to this person singing about this particular aspect and so on. Extracts from the broadside would be sung, the audience would be encouraged to join in the choruses. And then sales were actually made, and the audience would be left in suspense about the conclusion of the tale, because again, you would encourage sales of books, sequels, and so on. Other sellers of street literature also came in for much criticism from respectable members of society. In 1819, again interesting, this is just 2 years after we'd had the trial of William Hone, which you recall last week he was being done for sedition and blasphemy. In 1819, the residents of Oldham Street in Manchester presented a petition to magistrates complaining of the grievous message of... The grievous message of ballad singing by men and women corrupting the minds and morals of the public. Okay? Was there a relation between that and modern day rap artists, perhaps? Who knows? So the key thing that we've got at this stage is street literature was, to a generally positive extent, populist. It was also dependent upon oral tradition, it was dependent upon oral culture. It was seen how those oral traditions and cultures developed and worked through. And although it was bought in printed form, broadsides were not so much read as performed. They actually had their own particular structure. The tales had much in common with oral tradition. Even if you take something like this, it's a step-by-step structure in terms of how a song is developed, how we remember things. One of the reasons we use songs in oral tradition is because they help us remember. They keep us sort of able to transmit information from one person to the next. It's that shift from oral culture to print culture, which is at the heart of this whole system. Another element that comes through is a thing called dialect literature. And according to Vilnius, the hawker of street literature was, by the middle years of the 19th century, being forced out of many urban neighbourhoods and moved into other environments. We had a situation where in both Lancashire and Yorkshire, a range of dialects where stories would be told in the dialect of the particular region also proved to be very popular. And again, opened up the opportunity for more sales, greater spending power, and so on. We had names such as Ben Brearley and Edwin Hugh in Lancashire, John Hartley in Yorkshire. They would repeat the same plots and the same themes, but the messages would be told in Yorkshire, in Geordie, in Newcastle, in Lancashire, speak, etc. And it's actually estimated that from the 1860s onwards, in the Halifax dialect alone, sold more than 70,000 copies annually. So people actually quite liked to have their own particular dialect impressed and developed as well. And yet, we have a situation within Victorian London where you can still see, as we saw in week one, scenes of oppression, concern, the huddled masses looking for work, opportunities, and elements within that. Well, 19th century literature was certainly going through changes. We've seen the shift in terms of satire to a culture which was looking at the more softer aspects of Punch and so on. And the radical press primarily was dying away by the mid-1800s. These new cheap newspapers provided a lot of lessons about what working class people wanted to read. You know, if these numbers are shifting in the kind of numbers I've spoken about, in the millions, then clearly there's a market and an audience for them. A range of popular Sunday newspapers appeared in the 1840s. The late, possibly unlamented News of the World being one of them. And they made rapid breakthroughs into major circulation after the removal of stamp duty in 1861. These were titles like The News of the World, Reynolds News, Lloyd's News, and The Weekly Times. All of those newspapers picked up readers from the broadsides, from the broadsides' influence, and also those radical papers that focused on murder, crime, fires, scandal, lurid revelations of every kind. What did that mean? Well, if you're just dealing with the headlines and you're just dealing with the Banner disasters or the Taybridge disaster or the murder trial or the Last Will and Testament, etc., are you actually arguing about the causes, the issues that are actually seen there as being at the root problems? They weren't interested in reform, they just wanted to get the message out there. And you have that tension between what's seen as a reforming newspaper and what's seen as a simple entertainment newspaper. And that's something we'll go on to talk about, not next week, but certainly, well, actually partly next week with Provincial Press, but certainly 2 weeks' time when we consider Moral Panic and this whole concept of new journalism. There was a sense in this period that mankind was getting away from that in the 1800s. This notion of the wonderful magazine or marvellous chronicle consisting entirely of matters which come under the denomination of miraculous, whimsical, queer, absurd, odd, out of the way, strange, supernatural, and unaccountable. We were moving away from that into a more rational society. A rational society in which the notion of nature was something that could be subdued. It could be conquered. We could discover scientific principles that effectively would be a way of bettering the condition of the working class. But you've still got that tension. On the one hand, yes, Charles Darwin is developing his natural selection theory. We've got a whole range of other factors that are working through that. Wonders of technology are emerging, but at the same time, this whole notion of the working classes preferring escapism and entertainment to education is seen as a challenge. As the radical papers demanding social change began to fade away, they were replaced to a general, reasonable extent by what would be defined as improving literature. You get the development of the novel and novelists writing within that field. You get, as we've seen, writers like Charles Dickens, the Bronte sisters, and others beginning to actually express on paper what sort of areas they saw as reflecting society and raising issues that might need to be changed and adjusted. There was an increasing concern in Victorian Britain about the idea of respectability. Interesting, because on another level, as we'll see in the next couple of weeks, there was a level of hypocrisy which was quite phenomenal. But writers also argued that as people became more literate, with many of them, of course, learning to read at Sunday schools, there was a tendency to abuse that new skill. Again, this whole notion of reading the wrong ballads, cheap fiction, literature which was guaranteed to undermine morals and poison the mind and make people less respectable. Why, it's almost as bad as though they were playing Call of Duty day in, day out. It's not going to help people. In addition to that, There were a whole range of religious tracts and temperance material, like the one we saw about the Drunkard's Progress, which was also put out. Alcohol was viewed as one of the temptations which undermined the working classes. No change there, then. It led to violence, it led to domestic violence, it led to thuggery. And again, those who didn't read the right sort of improving material could lose sight of God, they could lose sight of duty, and could also put their own pleasure ahead of responsibility and the ambition to improve. The man who is not respectable, it was said, lives in a dark world, his comfort's diminished, his wife is untidy, his sons are vicious, and they terrorise the neighbourhood. So you have that line. If we look at some of the magazines that were also developed in terms of this street literature, we see they had names like Miss Trimmer's Family Magazine, True Britain, The Christian's Breadbasket, The Cottager and Artisan, The Friendly Visitor. Again, designed to appeal to predominantly middle and upper working class readers who saw themselves as the respectable moral majority. Again, key phrase to sort of bear in mind as we develop this whole area. And whereas the radical press of the early 19th century had emphasised fellow feeling and had talked about mankind standing together, the improving publications actually tended to stress things such as social division. There was a range of evangelical outpourings which was intended to be distributed by the superior, or self-perceived superior, to the social inferiors. Some would actually even ask their readers to give the publications to the poor who would benefit most from it. Now, unlike the radical reformers, writers for Christian's Breadbasket and so on tended not to really have any knowledge of the lower working classes, just some kind of notion that they were inferior. Okay, so we've looked at both extremes now. We've considered how the original oral tradition developed into the scandal aspects of the broadsides and aspects from that perspective. We've also looked at the growing notion of development, self-improvement and so on. What, you may well ask, have I had a slide with Kate and Margaret Fox with Sister Leah up for the last 10 minutes for? Well, the reason is as follows. These fine sisters were at the heart of what was effectively developed as a kind of bridge between oral tradition, history, charlatans, science, and so on. They had actually argued that they could communicate with people from beyond the grave. Major, major news story. Spiritualism coming to the fore. People could be existing in houses, and even though people had actually died, there was still a way in which you could actually communicate with them. It's Daniel Douglas Hume there. You could levitate, you could do all sorts of magical things. And why not? Consider the scene. The telegraph had been invented, not the newspaper, the actual device. A device which enables you to actually send information from one part of the country, say Edinburgh, to another, say London, or even across the sea to Paris. So if a telegraph can actually communicate over those large distances, and the scientific revolution is developing and growing sense and so on, why couldn't you communicate from the undiscovered country, from beyond the veil? And one of the other key elements that was really at the heart of this populist movement was the notion of escapism. Still with us, you might well argue. Otherwise, how can, you know, movies still continue to, you know, be popular and so on? Certainly by 1881, the majority of the poor, who were living in towns and cities, they had a range of sources of pleasure. As well as sport, which we'll talk about in future weeks, there was the music hall, there were songs, and there was a huge growth of theatrical entertainments which were very popular throughout the 19th century, particularly relating to melodrama, crime, adventure, and spectacle. So, we're left with that question. Allowing for the fact that superstition was still in vogue, that you could still have Blavatsky and Ollyett developing the Theosophical Society, addressing a whole range of issues and so on into the early part of the 20th century, how did this actually develop? was that growth rate in literacy, the growth rate of publications getting rid of superstition, magic, hauntings, etc.? Was it improving morals? Was it improving mental abilities? In other words, did literacy and access to newspapers actually replace superstition with scientific rationalism? Okay, let's consider spiritualism. In 1848 in New York, Kate and Margaret Fox, two of the Fox sisters we've just seen, communicated with a murdered peddler. In 1880, they admitted it was all a fraud. During that 32-year period, a craze had started, for reasons that I've just explained. You know, suddenly, if you had lost a family member, if you'd lost a child, if you'd lost a father, if you lost a loved one, the notion that you could communicate with them was absolutely, you know, irresistible. And why not? Blavatsky, Helena Blavatsky, and Henry Steele Elliott formed the Theosophical Society between, in 1875. Their sole purpose was to advance human learning through contact with spirits. Not vodka, gin, or others, but spirits as in a spiritual medium. Now, you know, there are people who would say, I want to believe. It's the X-Files, all over again. It may well be the case that as you look at these kind of issues, as you connect what's there, why shouldn't you, when you have somebody like John Worrell Keeley to hand, developing etheric energy, which he's showing a device of etheric energy there, which was designed to run trains and steamships on water. He was based in Philadelphia. Why wouldn't this be the case? You're seeing again that tension between oral history, oral tradition, reporting the facts, and a society which is designed to progress and develop. And the notion that science can solve everything. Well, maybe it can. What Keeley actually did get was lots of investors. A lot of those investors also believed in the occult practices and the notions of, yes, there are powers beyond which we exist. Furthermore, as we progress from that, they're more than happy to use this wonderful medium of the photograph, that other technology, to demonstrate their support for these activities. Now, I'm not going to go on from there to make the leap to the conspiracy theory that suggests nobody's ever landed on the moon, it's all been fake, because that's equally as ridiculous. But you can see how populist theories can develop to be perpetrated through the press to effectively argue against what's happening, etc. In 1917, Elsie Wright and Francis Griffiths came up with a chap. Well, they didn't come up, they didn't invent Arthur Conan Doyle, but they were supported by Arthur Conan Doyle, who obviously created Sherlock Holmes, amongst many other sort of aspects that he worked through. And he was convinced that fairies existed. Look, there is absolute clear proof that on the Cottingley Garden, you have a fairy that's actually there. When was this? 1917. Remember the thing I said week one? Always ask yourself what's happening culturally at the time. 1917? Oh, that's 99 years ago. Yeah, First World War, the Great War, is happening. People are dying regularly. Lots of reports that are allowed to be published and printed coming across from Flanders fields and so on. Is it beyond reason that actually, in terms of seeking some escape, maybe, just maybe, you might actually look to something like fairies and say, oh yes, they could maybe exist, etc.? Surely it has to be true. Photographic evidence. The camera never lies. If this was a song, if this was being sung about in a ballad, you would take it as a story. It is a story. It's a very popular story. But actually, it wasn't until 1977, when a researcher found the original drawings of the Cottingley Fairies, that the issue was challenged at all. And it wasn't until 1982 that Elsie Wright and Francis Griffiths effectively admitted that, just like the Fox sisters, it had also been a fake. So again, the key things to come out of this whole scenario is basically popular printed materials don't just cater for an increasingly politicised readership. By no means all readers had that evangelical take that Lovett had said, who sought to actually gain really useful knowledge from their reading. Many of the increasingly literate population simply wanted to be entertained. They wanted to watch the soap opera of their day, or read the culture of their day, or immerse themselves in the story of the day, and be carried away for a moment by Jules Verne with his mysterious island, his trips to the moon, H.G. Wells and The Invisible Man and The Time Machine and War of the Worlds and so on. All of those areas which begin to start becoming popular and again continue in popularity in different media forms right up to the present day and probably beyond. Now, as we've seen, what this produced was a vast array of street literature. Street literature which succeeded in entertaining the market. In large part, it succeeded by perpetuating aspects of oral culture. You can go back and look at tales of mermaids and fairies and ghosts and goddesses and elves and witches and goblins right the way back to almost the sort of, well, actually, indeed, the Stone Age. In all cultures, there is, as Carl Jung actually says, the anthropologist, a key sort of almost human need for this. How do we see them to now? We see them in movies, in cinemas, in stories, and so on. And writers were paid fairly modest sums to churn out a steady stream of broadside articles. It was their job, churning out the stuff, regardless of the information of their origin, accuracy, and so on. Many of the publishers grew very rich on the basis of the broadsides. And again, they very much focused on sales and the positivity of that whole sort of scenario. And yet, as we'll see, was it all bad? Well, maybe in succeeding weeks we see that the writers and publishers of broadsides did undoubtedly have a great influence on the way in which popular newspapers and journalism actually evolves. Not least in the way that they use attention-grabbing headlines. If we look back over those slides and we look at the headlines that were actually being used and developed at the time, they use the same kind of traditions as you see in the broadsides and tablets today, especially in terms of the use of headlines right at the top, the banner headlines, the things that grab your attention. That's the first time it's being used from that perspective. By the second half of the 19th century, street literature was in decline. You know, other aspects such as music halls, such as sport, such as other activities were actually replacing the use of leisure time by people who clearly would have obviously initially been fascinated with the onset of broadsides and chapbooks and literature within that whole field. But as we sort of head next week towards the notion of the local press, that voracious readership was of benefit to all sorts of other areas and continues in this particular segment of reporting continuity and change. And with the time coming around to 1543, using the spooky device that's here that actually manages to relate to beings from beyond, I see it's time to say farewell for this week. I'll see some of you in a seminar straight afterwards, and the rest of you later on in the session.